Are you ready? It's the That's Funny edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, an interview with local funny man, Harmoon Eftris.
Eftis, good job.
Yes, and if time permits, we might talk about the boycott of Russia and Mega Vitamins Megamyth. Let's begin episode 222.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of dark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Freethinker 2.0. This is Don, your political science philosopher, here in the studio. Today, joining me is Harmoon, the funny man. Say hello, Harmoon.
Man, hello. It's Harmoon. Harmoon. Why does everybody insist on calling me Harmoon?
Isn't there an R in your name?
There really is no R. I thought it was just a misspelling. For how... You've known me for a very long time.
I have. Yeah. I'm sorry. So, Harmoon. So, tell us a bit about yourself, Harmoon, just roughly. So, the reason why I brought Harmoon on here is because, well, you know, we've worked together for a long time. He has a good intellectual background. He has a degree in political science. He has a life degree in comedy, being someone who goes out there and is willing to stand up a bunch of people and have them laugh at him on purpose. So, again, tell us a bit about yourself, Harmoon.
Well, my name is Harmoon. Oh, no, wait. It's Harmoon without an R. Can we redo that? No? Okay. Well, as you may have noticed, I kind of sound like Kermit the Frog. It's kind of a nice thing. I don't know whose idea it was for me to be on radio. I guess it was you, Don.
I wasn't going to ribbit it in, but yeah, so you do sound like Kermit the Frog.
And my best asset is I kind of look like a fat Jeff Goldblum, but you can't see that on radio.
Oh, the psychics can. So we're covered on that as well.
That's all good. But yeah, I write. I do stand-up comedy. And one thing about stand-up comedy... When you get up there and people laugh at you, that's actually good. The bad part is when you get up there and nobody laughs. And that happens quite often as well.
So before the show, we were talking about your extensive... about how I wanted to label you as a comedian, and you didn't think that was quite appropriate. So how would you label yourself?
Well, I'm a comedy connoisseur. The thing is, the reason why I don't want to say comedian is because I don't want to identify with just doing comedy. Or even if I was, like... top of the world in comedy, I still wouldn't want to identify as that. I'm just somebody who writes jokes. I write stuff, and it just happens to be funny sometimes.
Okay. So, ostensibly, I have you here on the show sort of as my personal comedy expert. So I guess maybe it won't be as funny as I thought it was, but still. Why do you want to be a comedian? Why do you like to write comedy? You know, what makes you funny?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that I like it. I mean, let's be honest. First of all, by the way, you have a really wobbly chair here. This is a
during the commercial break, we can do a chair transplant. I know it's a risky operation, but we have the technology.
Okay, let's try that. But you know, I like comedy. It's a interesting thing to do. For me, it's a very cathartic thing. I like to just go up there and talk and say things that are in my mind, in my soul, in my heart, Don.
Yes. Well, I've worked with you. I question the existence of that, but
it's there. It's,
you keep it in the fridge, don't you? Next to the.
Well, I keep several hearts in my fridge.
So on the show, as our listeners probably know, we like to take a skeptical look at things, sort of use our rational toolkit. It's been claimed by some, and quote, it's common knowledge that laughter is the best medicine. So, I personally think penicillin is probably better medicine, but still, actually, apparently there are some pretty good medical reasons to laugh. I did a bit of research on this, and if any moment, Harmoon, you want to jump in, let me know. So, what are some of the best benefits? It can decrease stress. It does this by decreasing the hormone levels of cortisol and epinephrine.
Cortisol and epinephrine. Look at it. I'm the comedy expert. I don't even have notes. I'm so good at this.
So, under prolonged stress, these hormones could cause suppression of your immune system, which is a bad thing. And, I mean, if you think about it, it makes evolutionary sense that, you know, it's important that when there's danger around, you know, and our fight-or-flight mechanism is kicking in, and that's sort of the root of all our stress, that we divert all our resources to basically finding safety. Our bodies assume that stress is sort of short-term and sporadic, which is a reasonable thing to do. Therefore, it can worry about infections later and deal with them then. However, we live in a modern world where stress is literally sometimes 24/7. You are quite stressed many times.
Sort of.
There's no resting period. So in a way, we're always sort of putting a half-assed effort into fighting infections, or our bodies are. And of course, with all these hormones flooding our system, it unbalances other hormone levels such as insulin, thyroid, and others. Another great thing it can do is it can reduce blood pressure and improve circulation. By revving up the bodies.
Oh, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to mention regarding the blood pressure and the stress that it's absolutely true. It has a direct effect on that. But also, let's remember the things that we do because of stress that add to the harm stress does, such as smoking, overeating, lack of exercise, or whatever we may be doing, that laughter is a good remedy to get you off of those things. So, you know, you really can't laugh and smoke at the same time. And maybe you can.
I've seen some people on TV who have, I think could have managed it. Uh-huh. Andrew Dice Clay comes to mind.
Well, he smokes, says a joke, first of all, he doesn't really laugh that much. He's the one making others laugh.
No, but he strikes me as someone who is an official who could make it happen.
Yeah, it's possible.
Up the nose or something while you're speaking, just to you know, sort of. So it does reduce blood pressure, improve circulation by sort of revving up the blood circulation, increasing oxygenation to the blood. Laughter may actually be a powerful ally in the fight against heart disease. University of Maryland conducted a study linking laughter to cardiovascular health. The result indicated that laughter seemed to cause endothelium. Tissue that comprises the lining of the blood vessels to expand, allowing for better blood flow. It also helps play a crucial role in fighting off atherosclerosis and the thickening of our arteries.
Are you saying if it does that to the blood, you're saying laughter could also act as Viagra? It's a possibility?
Well, so it'd be a roundabout, because if it does expand and allow for greater blood flow, then yes. And actually, I would say the opposite is probably much more true, that if you aren't laughing and you're under stress or you're just depressed or whatever, that decreases blood pressure and blood flow, which does make it harder for things to get up and going.
Well, that actually explains why my ex-girlfriend would always laugh when I took my pants off. That was she was just trying to be supportive.
Of, yes.
Given my erection.
It goes against the greatest joke I ever heard. The best form of birth control is laughter.
Mm.
You know, but
the greatest joke you've ever heard, really, of all time. That is okay. Fair enough.
Well, on that, yeah, no, actually, it was good. It's clean too. Hamoon changes chairs.
I get to change chairs now. This is excellent.
Yes. Well, it's hilarious to see him in the studio. He's like riding a unicycle. It's quite funny. So I'm going to continue on. It also helps with diabetics mediate their glucose. In a study by Hayashi, in which they had two groups of people, one with type 2 diabetes and the other non-diabetes, you know, they were eating a common meal. Then one night, they took them to a lecture deliberately contrived to be boring, hopefully not one I did. And the diabetics, you know, needed their regular level of medication because of increased glucose in the bloodstream, which is what you would expect. However, the next night, they repeated the experiment, but this time the group attended a comedy club instead of the lecture. The diabetics showed that there was no increase in the glucose levels. The research is still, obviously early days, and the authors suspect that this is something to do with laughter's impact on the neuroendocrine system, and also assuming that they were good jokes that they were hearing. I imagine if they were bad jokes, it wouldn't have the greatest effect. Laughter is also free morphine. Excluding the cover charge to get into to see the. Do you have a big cover charge?
Well, all I ask for is actually some morphine. So if you can get free morphine, I'll let you in any show.
Laughter produces endorphins, which again is the brain's built-in painkillers. It can also provide, you know, emotional release for painful or sad situations. There is some research that apparently shows that the physical act of laughing can help with digestion and alleviate lung congestion. I'm not quite sure how the digestion would work, but the lung congestion seems kind of obvious, you know, any exhaling. We already mentioned that it can help prevent stress. It also can help by preventing stress from suppressing the immune system, but it seems that some lymphocytes, including the B cells, which are used to fight infection, and the T cells, which help fight viruses and manage the immune response, are positively affected by laughter. Interferon gamma, which assists in the immune response and deters tumor growth, these levels are also shown to increase with laughter. And laughter has also been shown to increase the levels of salivatory immunoglobulin A, an important antibody that fights bacteria and infections, especially those in the respiratory system. Harmoon.
Just going to say, interferon gamma, isn't that what the Incredible Hulk?
No, that was just gamma radiation.
Oh.
Simple. Which would have killed him.
I don't think the Incredible Hulk laughs too often, though. That could be the reason why he...
Well, because nothing's interferon with him.
Oh, my God. This is awful.
Now, beyond the medical benefits, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, there's a lot of physiological and emotional benefits, you know, that, you know, a joke can sort of release the tension of a situation. It helps us overcome our fears by sort of joking at it. It's an excellent mechanism of social bonding, or perhaps in the jokes I say, disbonding. Everybody likes a comedian. And lastly, of course, it's good exercise. So what do you think, you know, of these products of laughter? Are you thinking of adding an MD to the end of your business cards now?
Well, first of all, the day I get business cards is the day I will be shooting myself. Not a big fan of those, but, I agree. Those are great. Laughter at the end of the day just gives you a reason to live. I don't really think, when you think of all the great things in your life, you know, love and so on, those are very important, but laughter is right up there. I mean, most of your great moments in life have been laughing with your family, laughing with your kids. I guess those are your family for some people. absolutely. And another thing that it can do, and I think that might lead to other topics, is that laughter allows us to look at bad situations in our lives or bad situations in general and make them more palatable. So, you know, for example, Jon Stewart, that's an excellent way of looking at some pretty terrible news events, but still kind of laugh at them and kind of absorb them and not be horrified by them.
Do you know, sorry, trivia fact here, galeotology is the study of laughter and its effects on the body.
Sorry, what was that?
Galeotology. Galeotology.
Galeotology.
Yes.
So I'm a galeotologist.
Yeah. No, there's no. That's a study of different things. But actually, on the note, because you kind of did bring it up, what do you think of something like the Colbert Report or The Daily Show, which has sort of replaced most people, you know, 30 and under's news source? And they do. They tackle some pretty horrific things on the show, but they do it in a comedic aspect. Do you think that diminishes their comedic cred because they're sort of belittling horrible thoughts? Or does it diminish their news cred because they're not taking some things as seriously perhaps as they could?
Well, I think, it kind of goes to the root of what you want to consider comedy. But at the end of the day, comedy is about bringing to the forefront things that are wrong with society, with our environment. We may discuss this a little bit more, but I genuinely believe that laughter and comedy are hardwired from our monkey or ape. I guess we are apes. Our past as hairy creatures. Again, both of us kind of hairy.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, from those days, we kind of have this hardwired social bonding mechanism that kind of warns others. So it's like laughter is an immediate response in order to warn your social group of things that are wrong in the environment. So you kind of find it funny if you watch an old lady slip on some ice.
Well, yeah.
Some of us might.
You might find that funny.
I find it hilarious. Anyway, but that's, and it seems like a cruel thing, but actually your laughter, it's initiated because you're trying to warn other people that looks like, hey, that looks like smooth, safe to walk on ground, but look, that's dangerous. So something that appears to be one way is actually not the way it appears, and that's your way of informing your group. So when Colbert or Jon Stewart, you know, when they do their show, that's almost exactly what they're doing. They're just doing it at a much more sophisticated frontal lobe kind of level, where you're looking at the way politics should be, the way the media should be, but then at the end of the day, it's not that way, and that's what causes it to be funny to begin with.
So, wouldn't it be smarter, though, if there is ice over there, of me to say, hey, there is ice over there, as opposed to, look at the old lady who fell on the ice?
Well, again, I think it's just a remnant of the monkey past. So, yeah, I guess if monkeys could do that. But I think it's just, you know, like a chimp just giggling or just going, ah, sounded like that. That's really what it is. It's just it's hardwired into us, and we use our more advanced brains in order to use that biological mechanism for other things, but it is ultimately, that's the root of it, most likely.
So what do you think then about the idea that, again, that the major news source now is a comedy show? What does that say about society in general?
Well, I don't know why news has to be so serious to begin with. Now, like, the good thing about those particular shows is that they don't make light of the suffering of the people or anything like that. They're not making fun of anybody's suffering. They're so much making fun of the hypocrisy, which is so evident. I mean, if you watch CNN, there is just so much BS consistently that you just can't. I mean, I watch CNN and I laugh at it in my own head. I think most people who watch CNN have the exact same reactions. I mean, most of what Jon Stewart does is not really, you know, add jokes to it. He just shows you the clip, and the clip speaks for itself as dumb and funny, and he just adds little tags to the end of it to, you know, make it more amusing. But at the end of the day, it's really the news itself that's really funny. He just kind of, He doesn't pretend that it's serious.
Do you think that's a unique thing for this day and time, or is this like, have people been making fun of the media, our news media, since time immemorial?
I mean, I guess just from when we're watching movies and stuff, like ancient Rome, where you had the theater in the streets, and Shakespeare had some comedy in his stuff. Well, although, I mean, right off the top, I had Macbeth and the Porter that's peeing all over the place. Yep. Although that's kind of not the main subject of the story. I hope it's not anyway. Originally, that was actually Shakespeare's whole thing. It was a 2-hour play on the Porter peeing, and he said, you know, I'm just going to...
Yeah, I need some filler.
Yeah, the king character was, hey, it was kind of interesting. And maybe you should kill this king with pee? No.
Oh.
Stop saying that.
On that urinally sort of Cajun thing. Let's go to a bit of a break, and we shall return when we return.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
CITR is proud to support the 20th anniversary season of the Enchanted Evenings concert series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden. Unwind at the end of every week with an eclectic musical performance. All concerts begin at 7 p.m. every Friday from July 5th to August 30th. For more information, go to VancouverChineseGarden.com.
And we're back! So, going back to a funny thing, it seems that laughter actually isn't unique to humans, and you were kind of hinting on this. It seems that chimps, bonobos, and even rats and dogs can laugh. But not strictly speaking is it sort of stand-up comedy. The actual culprit for the merriment in those particular cases is tickling. Is tickling comedy?
Well, I find it very hilarious when I get tickled. No, I absolutely agree. I do believe, though, that, yeah, animals we share that same biological mechanism. It's just we use it for different things. We just exploit it. Same as reproduction. Sex is a biological mechanism that all multicell organisms, sexual multicell organisms, partake in. But we use it for fun. We do weird sex things. We put on masks. We pretend to be Batman. We call our lover mom and tell them we wear skirts made of cut-off penises. I mean, that's...
way more information than I really need to know. But it does fill out the character. I now know you better than, well, I probably ever wanted to. I was going to go on to, does it bother you the fact that in theory you could have a rat stand-up comedian, and maybe you've met one, but you way outdid me on that one.
Yeah, severed penis is always the way I go directly to that.
So, comedy is, well, old. It's been out for a while, probably as old as humanity. As you sort of hinted at, most scientists sort of think that, you know, we are innately born with the ability to laugh, and that it's one of the things that we start doing before we really start doing anything. Probably pooping is the first thing, but that's probably number two. The oldest recorded joke is from Sumeria and can be dated back to the 1900 BCE, roughly. Are you ready for it?
Let's go.
Something which has never occurred since time immemorial. A young woman did not fart in her husband's lap. Ba-dum-bum.
That's Sumerian?
That's Sumerian.
Those Sumerians have a good sense of humor. That could still work today.
Well, you know, I know people who say you can never go wrong with a fart joke. Farts are just innately funny.
Well, as you said, the only thing that precedes laughter is probably pooping. And
what else? But it's just an aerial form of poop.
It's just the word itself, poop.
The second oldest, and this one actually I can get a bit more, is from Egypt in circa 1600 BCE. How do you entertain a bored pharaoh? You sail a boatload of young women dressed in fishnets down the Nile and urge the pharaoh to catch a fish. Doesn't quite roll off the tongue, but you can kind of see where he was going for
that
one.
Well, you got to listen to it in the original Egyptian.
Well, and I must admit, if it's using the pictograms, it might also be a bit more racier, if you know what I mean.
Those Egyptian ladies.
The oldest English joke seems to date back to, and again, by oldest joke, oldest recorded jokes. People have been telling jokes, as you say, probably, look, old lady fall down. The oldest English joke dates back to the Anglo-Saxon times and goes kind of like this. What hangs at a man's thigh and wants to poke a hole that has poked often before? Answer? A key, you dirty little bird, you.
See, that is misdirection, the basis of all comedy. Just something should be one way, and you make that person think it's going to be that way, and just by twisting it, you make that person immediately go into that reaction of laughter, trying to warn the other monkeys, hey, it's not a penis.
It's the unexpected.
Yeah.
I want to do something unexpected right now, but I hadn't planned ahead, so I don't have anything.
Oh my God, you are actually undressing right now.
So here's a question for you, and your humblest of opinions. Mm-hmm. Do you think the joke has evolved much over the year? You kind of imply that it hasn't.
I don't think so. I think it's still all about identifying things that are one way that should logically and rationally be another way. You know, from Jerry Seinfeld, that he does that with his observational humor, to the, you know, 1950s jokes, where it was jokey jokes, you know, take my wife, please, you know, those kind of jokes. Everything is about misdirection. Everything is about taking a person's mind one direction and then twisting it.
Well, let's go into that then. So you, besides telling jokes, you are a craftsman of humor, of forms, maybe a whatever level you want to put yourself at. What makes a joke funny? And is there a difference between jokes in themselves or routines, which tend to be much longer, from a writer's point of view? Or are they sort of the same thing, but just one with more words than the other?
Well, I'm still in my experimental period in that, but I just to answer the last part first, I think routines are just an expanded form of the joke. As long as you're able to take somebody's mind in one direction and twist it at the end, then that's going to be funny. Now, someone like Louis C.K., where you look at his comedy, and it is so difficult to identify the jokes, but there are clearly little jokes tied together into one longer routine. But then there's someone like Bill Hicks, who just rants. Honestly, he just rants, and you can't really identify single little jokes.
But these are famous comedians, and mm-hmm. you're kind of saying that they're comedians, they're hilarious, but they don't really tell jokes.
Yeah. I mean, they tell jokes, but the jokes are very hard to identify.
Doesn't that make it hard to laugh at them?
No, because, again, laughter is not a rational thing, so you don't have to rationally know where the joke is. You just have to respond to it. And that's the beauty of humor, is that you can't fake... I mean, you can fake laughter, but it's pretty obvious when laughter is being faked. I know I'm funny, man. That was my funniest thing I ever said. But yeah, you can't really fake it. So you're directly bypassing the frontal lobe and just going to the monkey brain and tickling it.
So what's your process? How do you do it?
I've never actually written a successful joke with this process directly, but it always leads to my brain coming up with jokes, like when I'm in a toilet or in a shower or whatever, just randomly popping up around the time where I do this process. And what I do usually is I would make a list of all the topics I find funny, so like 10 topics that I find are kind of interesting to talk about, and I just brainstorm. And then what I actually do, and this is what I found works best for me, is that I actually write punchlines first. So I write the punchline, and then I take every punchline and I actually write the premise for it by later. And that way I can actually identify the twist in the joke much better. In fact, I'm creating the twist because I just basically have to write the opposite of the punchline. So I know where I want the joke to be. All I have to do, the hard part, is how to trick the audience into following me but not knowing exactly where I'm going. So I just write the opposite of the punchline.
Do you have a joke? Like, for example?
Oh, that's okay, well, one joke, this is actually, I don't know, it's kind of funny, but it's kind of, but I'll just explain it because I don't want to do the joke per se, but.
No, do the joke. And then you can go back and you can dissect it.
Okay, well, this is the thing. It's very difficult for something to be funny when there is only one person because, again, there's nobody else.
There's thousands of people.
Oh, that's true.
Actually. Billions, I'm sure.
Okay, well, one joke would be. It's always very interesting that my body and my mind can never really agree on my level of fatness, because my mind it's living in 2013. It understands what's going on, so it's looking at the mirror, being like, "Dude, you just got fat. You gotta lose this weight." But my body is an idiot. It's still programmed for the Stone Age, so it's looking at my body going, "Huh? Man, I will be set for the dry season. I am set. Look at all this fat I put on." And really, the entire dry season is just going to be the dry season of pussy that I'm not going to get this summer. that would be a joke. That's a joke that I wrote, but I didn't really... Like, I did that process, and I was just in the shower, and that idea came to me fully formed, and all I had to do was just write it and cut out excess and rewrite it just to make it shorter and shorter. And of course I butchered it, by the way. I butchered my own joke. That is the lamest excuse you've ever heard.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, I've heard lamer things. Sometimes at work with you.
Yeah.
Moving on then. So there's been lately, well, perhaps always been, a debate about the boundaries of comedy, you know, where they exist. Historically, you know, you had to be careful who is the brunt of your joke. If you make fun of the king, off with your head. That said, comedy has often been used as to address, you know, inequality, racism, sexism, poverty, and many other social ills. It has also often been condemned often while performing this particular social role, as being offensive and obscene. First, in your view, do you agree that social good socially good comedy can be done? And, you know, or is it just sort of it's just a joke, guy?
I think absolutely you can do, again, social issues can be boring, they can be uninteresting, and comedy can spice them up, make them interesting, easier to absorb. But you don't have to. I mean, what's funny is funny, and I don't buy into the idea that somehow socially conscious humor is somehow in a higher level than just standard funny joke. If a joke is funny and it makes you laugh, then it's served its purpose, and that's ultimately what the goal should be. Absolutely. I think you can totally make, like, look at Dr. Strangelove. That is a comedy, but it's a very dark subject. I mean, we're talking about the end of humanity, kind of, and it makes it funny.
But I mean, it got criticized at the time for being insensitive to certain people, and that sort of leads into my second question, is what, in your view, is offensive? What's obscene? What's similar or different between the two, in two words or less? Okay, you can use more than two
okay,
words.
Okay, thank you. I was trying to figure that out. I don't think there should be boundaries to humor. Honestly, when a joke is offensive, most of the time it's because it's not funny. If a joke is funny, then you can look through the offensiveness of it and be like, oh, well, there's a reason why he told that joke, because it's hilarious. But if you just say something and it's kind of funny, but it offends people and it's not worth the offense that it brings along with the funny, then no, it's totally acceptable for someone to be offended by that, because there was no reason to make that joke.
Well, what about someone who is, let's go with maybe the Dr. Strangelove, might be shoehorning a bit, where it may be making a valid commentary about the military-industrial complex and the threat of nuclear war, but if you happen to have been a Jew who went through the Holocaust, the references to Nazism may have offended you. What do you think of that sort of issue?
Well, I think in that specific case, definitely you can't blame the movie, because that is a thing that happened in real life that we have to deal with. And, if it was, it's sort of like Schindler's List dealt with very direct, horrible things, but it wasn't a comedy, so people didn't get offended by it. But I guess people would see something that is a comedy tackling a very serious, dark subject that could be offensive, and saying, well, it's not worth it because it's just a comedy, because it's somehow a lower form of art.
I think something you said earlier sheds light on this, but I don't think it's shared by most people in general. Now, you mentioned that one of the things that comedy does is to warn people, that it's not to lighten the issue, but almost to amplify the particular issue. But I don't think that's commonly shared. So I think one of the reasons why people might have no problem with the Schindler's List, because it is showing what they would consider to be the proper amount of respect. Mm-hmm. Whereas Dr. Strangelove, or I'm sure there's a better example out there, seems to be making light of the issue, that somehow it's not important, and that's where the offense is taken.
Yeah, well, I think that's... I generally believe a comedy could be as serious as Schindler's List. It's just a matter of, socially, we generally only want to laugh when we're having a good time, having a drink with friends. It's not, but laughter can be equally powerful in changing your opinion of a subject. Than anything serious. I just think people don't take comedy as serious of an art form, and I think that's just simply because drama and movies and so on has always taken the role of being the socially conscious type of medium.
Recently, there have been a number of comedians who have sort of fallen for grace for using the N-word. Others have been condemned for making rape jokes. I remember one particular joke of yours that I didn't think was perfect, or at least it would not have gone over well with the mentally challenged type people. Oh, and boy. In the context of this particular conversation, I don't mean that as a joke. I mean that sort of seriously. So, are there boundaries or lines that a comedian should not cross? If so, are there exceptions or particular purposes that crossing these lines may actually serve a greater good?
Well, not to defend the joke, but I was thinking about this being brought up, and that is a terrible joke. It's just not a funny joke. I'm not even going to mention it. It's not funny, but It's true. It was something that was... the joke discusses a complex dilemma that I was having in my head, where it was I was seriously being annoyed by a kid, but the kid had Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. Now, I somehow felt if the kid didn't have Down syndrome, I would have still been annoyed, but I would have been okay with being annoyed. But I felt bad about the kid having Down syndrome, and I just expressed that. Now, the joke itself wasn't that funny, but the actual topic was honest. So in that case, I don't think there was any reason for me to not discuss that, because it was an actual thing that I actually thought. Now, when you talk about like the Daniel Tosh kind of thing where he said something idiotic, like, wouldn't it be funny if five guys just raped that chick, right? That was not only was it not funny, it wasn't really honest. It wasn't something that was coming from his heart. It was just something that he said to get back at a heckler, and that was totally junk. So I think if you're genuinely saying something that is absolutely honest, you probably have a responsibility as a comedian to yourself, because ultimately you only have a responsibility as an artist to yourself, to express it the way that is most direct and honest. Now, again, the failure of that joke was that it wasn't funny. I don't really feel bad about saying what I did, because most of it was about an internal conflict that I think a lot of people probably would have in that situation. But, you know, I just happened to express it and try to make it into a joke. It didn't quite work out too well for me.
Well, okay, so now I'm going to defend you a little bit. The joke I thought was funny. There was the one premise to it that I thought was not politically correct, for a better term. But you do bring up another interesting question that maybe we can explore a little bit. You said the reason why it was different was because you had an emotion and you felt guilty about the emotion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That if you were just annoyed and it was, for lack of a better word, a average person, you would have been, great, no problem, I'm going to go over there and smack the one on the head, tell him to shut up. Mm-hmm. But because this person wasn't, you felt guilty for that, and that somehow put you into an internal conflict. I'm wondering how much of bad comedy maybe is an expression of this internal conflict. I mean, let's use the heckler for the particular joke. I mean, obviously, you're annoyed at this heckler. But at the same time, to a certain degree, you know, we live in a male chauvinist sort of society. To sit there and make fun of a woman may be deemed as sexist, and you don't want to go. So now you have this conflict in your head. Do you think that plays out at all? Or?
Well, this is the thing. Using the Daniel Tosh idea, or using the Michael Richards, I think his name was.
Yes.
It's fallen out of grace so much.
Kramer,
yeah. Using the N-word, the problem with those situations were that there wasn't really no conflict. It was just straight up hatred. It was just anger, and anger directed without any sort of point to it, towards people. Now, if a perfect example, Louis C.K. uses the N-word on stage, and he actually, you know, discusses how the N-word itself is about, but he's actually discussing the inner conflict. He's not saying that it's okay to say it. He's just saying that if you're going to say it, don't say something N-word, which I'm saying it because I really think it's a horrible word. But he's saying, well, just saying N-word doesn't take away the power of the word. It just allows you to say it without getting the blame for it. So ultimately, he's discussing a conflict. And that's what makes that, I believe, one of the best jokes I've ever heard. Whereas Kramer was just being angry and yelling at somebody and really using that as an insult. Like, the way it's absolutely the worst way of using it.
We're going to go for another little break, maybe have a coffee, go for a pizza, and then we'll come back in a minute or so. We'll be right back.
In the sky, standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about 4 times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, and People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
And we're back. So we ended the last little bit off on an interesting thing. This is a bit of a tangent. So Hamon's going to be sitting there going, why are you talking about this? I don't know anything about it. But we talked about the N-word. And I'm curious to know, in your opinion in particular, is there any difference in saying N-word versus nigger? Right? I mean, if I sit there and I'm saying, you stupid N-word, I haven't used the N-word, but obviously, I mean, everybody knows what you mean. Is there any real difference between the two?
No, it isn't. I just feel so uncomfortable saying nigger. I just feel so uncomfortable saying it. Honestly, I just do it for my own sake. Like, it raises my blood pressure saying that word. And it's not because I'm afraid of anything. It's just the one word. Like, look, there are horrible words out there that are racist words. Like chank or sand nigger. But those don't, the problem with those, and they're horrible, they're not, they don't bring up 400 years of deep dehumanizing of a people that only really were freed just, you know, 150, 160, 70 years ago. I can't do the math very well in my head.
No, but so, well, one could argue that, again, let's say anti-Semitism comes to mind, dates back a little bit longer than at least African-American slavery, right? I mean, slavery in general is an age-old tradition that has been going on since probably the third thing we did after laughing was bop someone over the head and said, you're not doing my dishes. But you already said that there's actually times and places where it's appropriate to use this as sort of a tool to get at deeper issues.
Mm-hmm.
What about comedy in general? I mean, we sort of have boundaries, and you said there are certain things where, you know, you wouldn't cross. But do you think that in the service of doing a social good, there is no joke that cannot be told, provided it states its purpose?
No, absolutely. Again, going with the Louis C.K. thing, again, that's a perfect example. That's a totally acceptable use of it, because you're trying to bring to attention something that is unrelated to that word. And you have to use it in that case. You have to use it. I'm just against the idea that you can, you know, there's Joe Rogan who has it, who makes a joke. And again, it's honest and it's true. And that's he does use that word, just not when black people are around. But when his white friends are around, of course he does it, because it's a cool word. But you know, is in that situation, I personally wouldn't do that, because I don't find that to be worth using that word. It's just that one specific word is so high up there in the sacred words that should only be used for really, really rare reasons. And that's same kind of true is true about words, or not words, but like concepts like rape, pedophilia, things like that. You can make fun of those things, but you really got to be careful what you make fun of them. Not because you want to avoid offending people, but because it's so strong that no joke that you make is going to be funny enough to compensate for using that word. You really got to save that for your AAAA material.
So you're kind of implying maybe that there's always sort of a social pressure against anything that's comedy. Now, most things, it's a very low-level pressure, so you can say your joke greatly. But if it's something that is very lightning bolt-ish, that's a much higher pressure. Therefore, your joke has to be, or your lead-up to the joke has to be much stronger in order to overcome that resistance in the audience to let themselves laugh at a joke that on one level they know they shouldn't laugh at because it's wrong. But perhaps on another level, they say, wow, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to go certain directions, and I've learned this the hard way, by the way, there, I don't care if you have a super, super funny joke. If it's not funny enough to justify using something of the most absolute offensive level, don't do it. Just don't do it. Just save it for your special material, because I just find it just cheapens the word, and it also, like, where do you go after that? Like, once you've tackled that issue but used like a B joke on it, now what are you going to tackle with your A jokes? You know, use your best material on the most incredibly difficult topics to discuss.
So it's sort of the Costanza philosophy. Once you've hit your George Costanza in one of the Seinfeld episodes says, once he sort of did the big joke or the smart thing, just get out of the room. Just, it's sort of like the drop the mic sort of.
Yeah. Just get out where you're ahead.
Now, we were talking before the show that you thought that the recent coverage of world events was kind of depressing, but you somehow found a light note in the particular comparison of some ex Disneyland character and Alan Thicke's kid.
Is he Alan Thicke's kid?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
You're joking.
I am 79.32% sure.
Wow, that is, I didn't know that. No wonder he's so cool. No. Basically, this is something that I saw, and I'm seeing it quite a bit on the internet now, and it's the whole Miley Cyrus nonsense, whatever. It's a stupid topic.
But what happened? What happened? For those of us who don't know, like me.
Like, you're probably the only one, because this thing has been on the internet all the past couple of days. Basically, she motorboated a giant teddy bear, stuck her tongue out in her underwear, and grinded Alan Thicke's kid's junk on stage. Now, again, not a big deal to me.
Right.
But what really just set me off was hearing people say, well, why didn't Robin Thicke get any negative press from that? Why was he not? As though there was some sort of a double standard, because we were near Women's Equality Day when that happened. So, people complaining about that's some sort of a sign that there's a double standard against men and women. Well, I believe there is, of course. But in that particular case, if Robin Thicke had taken off his clothes and ground it up, or, you know, motorboated a teddy bear, totally. But in this case, it was clearly Miley Cyrus just doing the most trashy, weird thing. I don't care if a guy does it. Like, look, Nelly takes his shirt off and does dumb stuff like that as well. I will gladly call Nelly out on that. But in this case, all that Robin Thicke did was wear a really dumb-looking suit and just stand there while Miley Cyrus acted like an idiot.
Wasn't that, though, a play on his video that he did, which was most people consider to be highly offensive. Teenage boys probably didn't, but everybody else said, you know, this is what's wrong with sort of pornography and that sort of thing. It's not that it's bad to have pornography, but when you objectify women and you treat them like an object, which he definitely was doing in the video, that's not a good thing to be portraying. And she's, and you know more about this, was she making fun of that video, or was she trying to pretend she was in that video?
I honestly think it was more just an excuse for her to distance herself from her Disney past. And it was her manager going, you know what we got to do, this Robin Thicke thing. It's very controversial. So what you got to do is you got to do something that one-ups that. So go up there and just grind on his crotch. And it worked. Listen, it worked. Like,
yeah, sure. Names out there, and there's the old saying: there's no such thing as bad press.
Well, absolutely. It's all that matters is getting your name mentioned as often as possible. That's what PR is. They don't care what the mentioning is, as long as you get it mentioned. It subconsciously enters people's minds. We're talking about Miley Cyrus. You're talking about Miley Cyrus. When you hear a song, you're like, oh, is this Miley Cyrus? Whereas some other artist that may have not been grinding on someone's crotch, but may have been much better musically, we will not identify as quickly.
Well, I know I'm just doing it to pander to our younger audience, because I don't know what a Miley or a Cyrus is, let alone what they'd be doing together. You know?
Well, that's weird. I would like to see Alan Thicke and Billy Ray Cyrus reenact that, because that would be hilarious. With achy breaky junk.
And, you know, you have to give her credit. Maybe she's evolving, because in the past, when you tried to do these sort of things, you'd accidentally, on purpose, release the sex tape where you did some horrible, well, depends on your taste.
Yeah.
Sex act.
Screech killed that. Once Screech had a sex tape, it was just like, sex tapes are not cool anymore.
On a note, again, this is all sort of related, because we were sort of talking about this as juxtaposition to something more serious. And you know some things about politics. You apparently have a degree in political science.
From this school.
Obviously not as good as mine, because I'm smarter. I wonder how would you have a duel between political scientists? Would you sit there and you'd throw down position papers until one of them either gives up or gets hired by the American government? Either way, you've lost.
Honestly, I ended up with that degree because I was high, and by the time I sobered up, I realized, oh, I'm majoring in political science. Shit.
What do you think about the Syria thing?
The Syria thing in general. Well, this we were going to discuss Russia as well, weren't we, at some point, if we get time.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have time for the Russia thing, so we're filling in with Syria.
Okay, well, the Syria thing, first of all, yeah, absolutely. It's going to happen. Like, they're looking. It's going to happen. They're looking for an excuse. But it's just, the reason why I was bringing Russia into it is just, like, Russia is the only, they're the only people supporting Syria right now. Russia is really not a good country to look up to as a role model of how to behave internationally. Holy, they are really just missing on every. But the whole Syria thing, we're definitely going to attack. Well, we're not. The U.S. is.
Actually, I just heard this morning that our defense minister is talking to the American Secretary of Defense to see how can we arrange things.
So we're going
to
send sandwiches.
Yes.
With Canadian bacon to.
Well, actually, what I understand is they're taking the Chrono Burger from the CN and they're going to lob that into Syria because apparently they've been killing, well, they haven't been killing, but they've been maiming Canadians. So they figure maybe this is a new Canadian weapon that we can use on others.
Maybe it's also an excuse to get rid of David Cronenberg. We can send him in there just to.
I don't think it's related to Cronenberg, but yeah, okay.
Well, no,
you just get mixed up because of the words, yeah.
We just want to send them. I just want to get rid of them because Existence is not a good movie.
So, but what do you think about the idea, though, that, you know, oh my God, they've used chemical weapons and now we have to act? Whereas, I mean, tens of thousands of Syrians have already died from regular weapons, and that's like, oh, well, that's okay.
Well.
To be fair, it's not okay, but we're not going to do anything about it, okay.
Yeah, I think the argument that the U.S. is making is, well, you know, now it's legally binding that there's precedent for chemical weapons for the U.S. to go in there without any problems. But, yeah, in terms of the actual damage caused, there hundreds of thousands were butchered without chemical weapons. So there's no moral benefit in waiting after the chemical weapons are used. Their argument is legally, it's much easier now because getting support would be very easy because the chemical weapons are, again, very much looked down upon.
But they still won't get a resolution past the Security Council because, again, as you mentioned, Russia.
Yeah. And China, is China...
China's bad. China was in favor of it because China, in general, doesn't like the idea of one country poking its nose into another country's interest in general. But even China now says, listen...
Yeah, this is pretty bad.
Yeah, there's cold and this is friggin' freezing,
yeah,
right?
This is one of the worst... Like, it's going to go down as one of the worst atrocities, well, first of all, of the 21st century by far,
yeah.
Over the last couple hundred years. I'm not saying I'm in favor of the U.S. just going in there and bombing the crap out of Syria and causing more damage or anything like that, but I'm definitely I'm definitely happy that it's being acknowledged by the U.S. now, or they've just kind of avoided the topic for so long.
But there's some other complicating issues about this, and again, this is more just a chat than anything, but you mentioned, you know, chemical weapons is a line, but in the 80s, the Americans gave information to Iraq that it knew it was going to use in order to use chemical weapons against Iran in their particular war. So again, not quite the clear line that I think we sometimes like to draw. I can also point out the things that in Libya, where we did intervene to protect people. There is an aspect to the UN Charter of the right to protect civilians. If a country's killing its own people, you do have a justification to step in and save them. But, I mean, Libya is mixed at best, but, you know, right now it's a very chaotic country. There is no real central leadership. There are jihadists and all sorts of bad people who, you know, aren't necessarily against our interests, although they maybe to a certain degree are definitely not what we consider a good thing to have happened. Isn't there the risk that in Syria that this same sort of thing, I mean, who do you help? You know, I mean, there seems to be like three factions. There's the chemical weapons users. There are the freedom fighters who would just as easily use the chemical weapons. There are sort of people we think are stable, but we don't know that because they're also people who believe in Al-Qaeda and that sort of brotherhood sort of thing. So, I mean, how would you, if you're now Barack Obama, and darken the skin a little bit, shave you a little bit more gray hair, well, what would you do in that situation?
Well, first thing I would do, I would bang Michelle Obama.
Okay.
Because why not?
Yeah.
Second thing I would do, well, first of all, I generally think it's just, this is really being backed by the Saudis. And when the Saudis want something in the Middle East, the U.S. kind of, they like to help them out.
Well, and to actually emphasize that, because again, another complicated issue is although the United States is condemning what's going on in Syria, they've been tepid about what's going on in Egypt. Right. And yeah, in Egypt right now, you know, you have the return of the military dictatorship, essentially. Hundreds and hundreds of people killed. Right. I think it was at 700 in one night or 600 plus some. Right. But how would you solve the issue?
I think generally what's really causing this is there is a huge shift in power right now. They're worried that Iran, Syria, they're gonna gain a lot of momentum against Saudi Arabia, and that's a problem. The Western world needs Saudi Arabia to be at the forefront of that region because they provide much of the oil. They keep OPEC alive, and we rely on them significantly. So I don't necessarily disagree with the idea of helping out Saudi Arabia because it is definitely in our benefit. I generally believe that if there is such a thing as super evil government, it is to be found in Syria and Iran. But at the end of the day, I think you want to go in there, you're going to get Turkey involved, you want to get Israel involved, you want to get the Saudis involved, and you want to make a coalition that will help out. Look, I can't solve this problem. This is a difficult. This is a big, big problem to solve.
Yeah, man. I was sending the email right, you know, live broadcasting this to the White House because he's sitting there saying, "I don't know what the fuck to do."
Well, I'm just saying, I would bang Michelle Obama in so many ways, and I would also use the N-word because now I'm black. I get to use it a couple of times without feeling guilty. Not a good use of that. Let's
we'll retract. Well, I think we've reached the end of the show. So, Hamoun, you are apparently a funny man. You apparently do this thing called sit down or stand up. I'm never quite sure what it is. Can anyone partake of your unique sense of humor anywhere?
Well, you know what? Anybody can partake, not on just my sense of humor, but if you want to do some open mics, I just want to mention Wednesdays and Thursdays at Goldie's. On Pender Street, Google it. Look, you can come down. You can actually try your hand at stand-up. Wouldn't that be fun?
No.
Not you. We know you would fail. Yes. We know you would be.
I have a long audience that says no.
The Lux Lounge on David and Howe, starting in September. And right now, the comedy finals for Patrick Mala's comedy competition, August 31st happening. So maybe check that out. Some good local comedy going on.
Excellent. Thank you again for sharing your time with me, Hamoun.
Thanks for having me.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars, a still more cool. glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way, the cosmos.